if you don't go back in and you're not responsive, if you're not actually having dialogue with the people that have taken the time to comment on your post, you're a pretty crappy author, frankly, right? You're a crappy user too.
Hello and welcome to the Brand New You Show, the podcast dedicated to helping you clearly and confidently market your brand so you flourish. I'm your host, Brandon Roten, and today's guest is Andy Cook. Andy is the founder of Linked Insights, where he helps people fix their LinkedIn problems and publishes insightful and actionable content about LinkedIn. And while he humbly refers to himself as a LinkedIn brand and content coach in his headline, I can confidently tell you he's more like a LinkedIn master. If you have a question about anything LinkedIn, Andy should be your go-to person. And if you're not following him, you should be. Andy, welcome to the Brand New You Show.
Hello, Ryan. Thanks for having me on, my friend.
No problem. Long time coming. I've been following you for what seems like forever. Always learned something from your posts or your articles or things that you're just doing. I mean, just sometimes just getting online and following what you're doing has been extremely helpful to me. And I think everybody else should be at least following you. And definitely paying attention because you are one of the leading guys that are out there on LinkedIn. So note to anybody listening, go follow Andy today if you're not.
Thanks, man. And right back at you because I think I've been aware of you for at least a year, year and a half. The name just rings a bell with me anyway. It's a cool name, right? Ryan Roten. I mean, it's Andy Foot. I'll take Ryan Roten. Thanks very much. Ryan Roten is a cool name, number one. Number two, we have many good people in common, but one in particular, who you may know, Gina Riley.
I might know Gina, yeah. I might have been texting her this weekend about this conversation right now.
So she was singing your praise, and I said, yeah, sure, I know Ryan, but no as in, well, you know, be aware of someone who is also active and killing it on LinkedIn. That definition of no. But yeah, Gina's is a very, very, very good and talented person for sure.
Yeah, Gina has actually been mentioned like in the last four or five podcasts I've done. So I should probably just make her a co-host.
Yeah, something like that.
All right. So I have so many questions. But I like to get all podcasts started off with the exact same question for all guests, which is, if you could vacation in only one place for the rest of your vacation days, where would you go?
So I am so unprepared for this question, you wouldn't believe, because I haven't listened to the last five, Ryan. I don't do my due diligence like that. So woefully unprepared am I. Yes. So, all right. Well, I'm gonna mention Gina's good name again. She's going to get tired of this. So she already went with the continent. I thought that was a very clever choice. So I can't choose Australia like she did because you said you would call that person out. I don't want to be called out on my debut on your podcast. And then I figured Seychelles. I mean, I had an amazing honeymoon in the Seychelles back in the day. But then I thought, well, no, it's permanent paradise, right? So Maui's in the same category. That would get boring quick. But also Seychelles, more importantly, is sinking. So that would be a bad idea. So I have chosen to go and do a time warp, Ryan. I'm choosing the Glasgow of my childhood because I have very strong evocative memories and everything was, you know, just through rose-tinted spectacles. If I think of Glasgow back then and what I was experiencing, I would consider it to be very exotic, which would amuse the heck out of any Glaswegians, I'm sure. But back, you know, when I was a child visiting Glasgow, I was doing a road trip from Germany where my father was stationed with the British forces. It would involve sea travel, a short hop across the channel, and then another longish road trip up north to Scotland. And then we would get there. It would be the smell of the tenement building. It would be the burgundy paint on the walls. It would be sucking on or chewing mints in a cupboard full of towels, right, that my granny and granddad would basically let me build. It was my little fort as a kid. And then the food, we had Uncle Louis come round. Every time Uncle Louis came round, he brought two pies, an apple pie and a cherry pie. I mean, so much is related to food. My memories of that time, that's where I would want to go back. And permanently, sure, that would be my staycation for sure.
Awesome. I like Uncle Louie, by the way. He sounds like a fun guy.
He was so cool. I mean, he worked as a stagehand. So yeah, I think he had a very, very rich life and saw some pretty cool things.
Well, don't feel bad about not saying Australia, because as you pointed out, Gina said it, but Mary Henderson, who I know you know as well, I just recently had her on the podcast. She said, you can't really beat the answer Australia, because it's the trifecta. It's the country, it's the continent, and it's an island.
Yeah. Mary Henderson knows her stuff. And yeah, she might be a little biased as well.
One of the things that I want to start off with that I found interesting as I was doing some research for the show is you've always been like the LinkedIn guy. You are actually a trainee solicitor at one time. So are you an attorney?
So technically I am not, because they require you to continually sign up and to register to be on the solicitor's role. So I came off that probably a good 15 years ago when I decided, no, I was going to say soliciting, but that's a completely different thing. Lawyering is not for me. And so that was that. I mean, I could have re-registered if I, you know, changed my mind, but I decided that it was grueling. I would walk past partners and they would be head down. Some would have their lights off. They seemed very miserable to me. And I figured, there's got to be something else. I know I trained for this, and sorry, Mom, I know you like the idea of your son being a lawyer, but I'm going to try something else. So yeah, I didn't like it. I didn't take to it. I think if I did the rotation differently, if I'd perhaps ended with litigation, that was my first. I did three stints: litigation, commercial property, and corporate. If I ended with litigation, I would have been a more confident person, I think, towards the end of the 24 months, and perhaps, you know, I would have found the love in representing clients in court. That certainly has always had an appeal.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so it's interesting. I mean, speaking for me selfishly, thankfully you didn't enjoy that, because you've moved into an area where you're adding, I think, just tremendous value in a completely different way. So I'm curious, how do you go from that career path to one where you were actually a career coach, you worked in HR, and eventually now LinkedIn?
Yeah, good question. So none of it was planned. All of it was ad hoc, and it was, this, you know, let me try this, or this door opens. One job actually I got via LinkedIn, because I was networking the heck out of it, and, you know, it works. And then one thing that I learned when I was working with Challenger Grain Christmas, for example, for a year and a half, that it's truly about the hidden job network, right? It's the ability to go to the people that matter. And the old expression, it's not what you know, but who you know, is so very important, right? If you're going to just apply through the job boards and pray and spray, then you're going to be jobless for a very long time, in transition for a very long time. So yeah, to answer your question, it was never planned. It was always ad hoc. And it was, okay, well, what do I fancy doing? What, you know, what do I want to do? And I've done everything. The thing I did after law firm was recruiting, but for lawyers. I then worked for the CBI, Confederation of British Industry, which is the UK's largest lobbying organization. I was on the account management side there. I then went to the States because I fell in love with an American lady. So she dragged me kicking and screaming to Chicago. I then did HR consulting, and then I worked in Charlotte, North Carolina briefly, where I was in the, and that was the job that I got via LinkedIn networking. And that was all about organizations and figuring out who sat where in terms of the organization, doing various techniques, including LinkedIn, but also web research. It was pretty cool. But yeah, LinkedIn was became my thing when I started writing about LinkedIn and sharing what I knew. And then one of the posts I wrote, most of them before that were pretty crappy, but this one, I found my groove and I started to essentially write how I speak. And I think that's the biggest takeaway, is if you write how you speak, then you come across as authentic and people recognize that. So, you know, my best posts, I think, are more like conversational. And this post was fairly unique back then, because I chose real life examples and decided to highlight why they were stunningly good and I was focused on the summary, what they call the about section. And it was unusual back then for actually, you know, for using screenshots of actual things, actual examples. And I highlighted these three and I figured, well, you know, what I'm saying here is very positive, so I'm sure they won't mind. And they, in fact, they didn't. They loved being showcased by me. And that was picked up pretty much very quickly after I published it by Google, by the Google bot, and put it on the first page for two very important Google search results. Number one, summary examples, and good summaries. And after that, I started to get thousands of views on my little blog. And I thought, oh, hold on a second, I better put a call to action at the end of that post. And the rest is history, because I kept on trying to replicate that value in the posts that I wrote subsequently. And, you know, I've managed to build up this juggernaut of a little blog that essentially is all about sharing value and not just answering the what. I think the sweet spot, Ryan, is the why, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why it's called Linked Insights. I'm not that interested in saying, okay, here's the latest, this has happened, and then moving on. I want to understand why it's happened, because I think that understanding then helps people in terms of their strategies.
So I want to go ahead and start our discussion about LinkedIn, starting off with something that you kind of called me out on just last week, though, speaking of the why. So I want to know the why. When you leave a comment now, sometimes you'll get the little note that says, see translation. And my comment was ditto.
Yes.
And then I got the see translation and you responded back. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I know you're still learning or something like that. So tell me, why did ditto trigger that?
Yeah, so I wasn't calling you out. I was calling the algo bot out, the translation bot. To be clear, I like to poke fun sometimes if I see stuff that's funny or weird, it doesn't make any sense. And yeah, so occasionally the algo translation bot will offer translation where it's actually not needed. And ditto was the example of that, because you know it's people understand what ditto is. I think in most languages. Yeah, so that's what was happening there.
That's funny. I've seen that pop up more often now too. So I guess for the message for people is, it may not be that you did something wrong. It's just that the bot seems to think that what you've written might need to be translated for someone else.
Yeah, it's a very cool option. And I've got on my browser, I've got a tab ready to go, which opens up Google Translate. So as soon as I see someone responding in a different language to something that I'm tagged on or some of my content, I will go into that and it's so quick. I can just put my English in. It'll translate it on the fly instantly. And then I copy and paste that. And the other person in that country will very, very much like the fact that I've taken the trouble. And it's been no trouble at all. I think everyone should do that. It's a slick thing. And it's something actually that, you know, maybe LinkedIn might incorporate in the future, because wouldn't that open up minds and communication channels by just being able to commute on the fly like that, just as Google Translate allows you to?
Yeah, I mean, well, you could create profiles in different languages, but you also have to do the copy paste thing. So why not just integrate it so it's easier?
Yeah, and LinkedIn needs to do a better job of enabling that. They should make it more automated, because last time I looked at this, it needs quite a lot of work to set up. Sure, once it's set up, it's done, but you need to invest a good, you know, depending on how many languages you want to translate your profile into, it could take half an afternoon for sure.
Right. So that was a comment that I made on a post that I was curious about what that meant. But what I'd like to know now is, it used to be articles was the thing on LinkedIn.
Yes.
You know, and then we got the news feed and now it's posts. So do people still write articles? I mean, is there a point to writing articles today on LinkedIn?
Yeah, so great question. I think there's still a point to doing it. And I think I'm going to be experimenting with this myself, Ryan. I'm going to take the posts that I've written in the past 12 months or so. By the way, I categorize those as articles in post wrappers. What do I mean by that? Well, my favorite form of posting for the past 2 years or so has been to do the post, but also attach a document. And that document is a PDF of X pages. So I'm sneaking my long form content in via that way, that method. But all of these posts are essentially like newspaper articles or newspapers. They get read and then they just get forgotten. And what I want to do is I want to take all of the evergreen content that's in those posts and I want to put them in as articles, and then I'm going to post them in my company page. So I'm going to give them a new lease of life doing it, you know, not as Andy Foote, but as LinkedInsights.com. And I'm going to see how that goes. But to answer your question, articles are definitely still worth doing because they do, I think, allow you to stretch yourself and to flex your intellectual muscles more simply by having, you know, more content space to play with. I do think it's a shame that everyone is all about the short, sharp fix of posts. Clearly, it's one of these things that is user-led, right? If everyone was not so interested in engaging around short-form content posts and were more interested in having lengthy discussions and analysis of white papers and all of that good stuff on the article side, then we'd be seeing more articles than posts. So it is user-driven, just like, you know, the Facebookization of LinkedIn is user-driven. People evidently want to have the aspirational, you know, deep sharing, yet sometimes quite fluffy, sometimes quite profound and sad. They want to see that content too. So all user-driven, but articles, I would say, particularly to my clients, you know, you've got to draw a line in the sand. You've got to basically stand up and say, hey, I can write and, you know, this is worth consuming. The other point about articles versus posts is that articles are indexed by search engines. So you'll get that index love, just as I was talking about my, you know, my stunningly great, stunningly good LinkedIn summary examples, that is still getting, you know, admittedly less love because I've updated it to a new one. So you'll get that, continue to get that. And a good friend of mine, Bruce Johnston, says, yeah, I still get hits. I still get inquiries, business inquiries from articles I wrote 4 or 5 years ago about LinkedIn. So the power of the long tail in that respect is real.
I'm curious on posts. You mentioned putting stuff into PDFs because I'm seeing a lot more posts with attachments, right? So either photos or what's really seems popular right now is PDFs where you can load up multiple documents and kind of scroll through it. And then videos, you know, because you like to test stuff, have you tested to see if there's a performance difference in any one of those types of attachments to a post?
Yeah, so I haven't tested with video as an example. I think video is a hard proposition on LinkedIn. It's hard for the main reason that you don't know what the content is until you actually, you know, start viewing it. And, you know, unless it's someone who you know regularly posits great video content, it's not something that I would necessarily be interested in seeing. And I think it's the exact same problem with LinkedIn Live. It's like, who has the time to watch this live and then the replay? Well, why am I going to watch the replay? What's in this content that is going to be interesting and relevant and valuable to me? I think that's always the issue with video. So I you know, to answer your question, I have experimented with images plus text, with just text, with text plus PDF, you know, attachments. And I think that's probably it, right? And the last one has done it for me because I really like the idea of sneaking in my long form content in that way. And, you know, as I said before, if I get to repurpose that, if it is truly evergreen and I can repurpose that into article form, maybe even put some of that on my blog, then it's not a complete waste in doing a post if you can, you know, use that content again and refer to it. And it's exciting as well because polls are now back after a 6 or 7 year absence. And I'm seeing a lot of engagement around carefully crafted polls, but no views, right? Which is really, really interesting that LinkedIn have decided, okay, you're going to get analytics with polls. You're going to be able to see, as the author, the poll author, you're going to be able to see who votes, which is pretty interesting always. And of course, you're going to see the vote numbers. And yes, we'll show you how many people engaged and you'll see the comments, but you're not going to get any views, which is really, really interesting to me as someone who watches these things. Why no views? So, I mean, if it was down to me, if it was my choice, if I was in the room at the table, I would say no views. No more views, because views are just impressions. They are scroll bys. They are not useful information, right? If you write something and someone happens to scroll by it, scroll by 50 or so things in the home feed, and yours is one of them, then what use is that to you, right? It's not helpful at all. I'd rather have clicks. When someone clicks, then they start measuring, and then we can talk about dwell time. So. Yeah, that's my long-winded answer to your question.
No, it's funny. It's I wrote down dwell time. I have a whiteboard as a desk, so I capture notes and things as you're giving answers, and I actually wrote down dwell time. Because one of the things I find is, especially with the PDF style kind of carousel in a post, if it's something interesting that captures my attention, I will sit there and look through all of it. Like anytime you put one out, I'm always looking through it. So I know that's helping your dwell time, which we'll talk about later in a few minutes. Yes. That's your story open loop right there. We're going to talk about dwell time and algorithms here in a minute. But one thing I'm curious about is, can you actually train your homepage news feed to not just be this random thing of posts that are completely not relevant to you?
Yeah, that's a great question and a great segue to dwell time. There were a lot of trainers back in the day is only a year, 2 years ago, that would say, oh no, look, the reason that you're seeing a lot of crap in the home feed is because you didn't train it, which is kind of difficult pill to swallow, because who has the time to do that? I mean, I don't have the time to train my home feed and it's messy. My reaction is, well, if it's a mess of content, irrelevant content that I don't typically absorb or want to read, interspersed with promoted content, right? If there's ads in there too, it's like, what possible reason is there for me to spend any time on this at all? To train it in the hope that it may improve, it may then serve more relevant. I think that's tough. It's a tough call, particularly if you've got a large network, Ryan. If you've got a lot of people who are posting and very few of them are posting stuff that's in your wheelhouse, then it's unlikely to be improved despite you trying to train it. So, that's the long answer. The short answer is I don't think you can train it, frankly. And I think LinkedIn realized that too. I think that LinkedIn realized that a lot of users were basically holding up the white flag and saying, no, I surrender. This is too much. I mean, I can't hide or mute and delete, or I don't want to unfollow. I'd rather not block someone, frankly, just because they're appearing in my home feed. So I think that's the mentality. That's the reality has set in on the LinkedIn data science side. And then they came up with, you know what?
Yeah, which we'll get to. So you said something in there as you're talking, like maybe you have a large network or you've connected. Yes. Like what most people do when they get started with LinkedIn is they just connect with all of their quote coworkers. So if you work at my company, you're a welcome connection. And then at some point, I think you start to realize the value of LinkedIn and you start to go, wow, I have this massive network of people who I don't ever interact with. There's really no value there. Do you recommend in those cases that you prune your network a little bit and start removing people from it in order to maybe improve your newsfeed or at least improve the value that you get from the platform?
Yeah. So another great question. The difficulty I have in theory with culling is that you're essentially trying to predict who is not going to be useful to you based on what? How can you possibly predict the person you connected with 1 year, 5 years ago is not going to open a door for you in the future? I can't do that, right? So there was a focus on the reason that you connected. There must have been some reason that you connected. Was it some commonality that you had, something that sparked that yes rather than an ignore? And just cling to that. I think the only time you really have to seriously think about culling would be if you're nearing the 30K maximum connection ceiling, which, by the way, is quite arbitrary, right? I mean, why 30? Why not 40, 50? And then you might think, well, crikey, if I get to 30,000 and then I have to start thinking about culling, A, that's never going to happen. B, it's never going to happen, right? It's like, right. You know, just slow your roll. Just don't connect with people if you're getting there, you know, 20, 30. I'm just about to get to 10,000 and I've been on the platform for, what, 8 years or so. And people are wanting to connect with me. I very rarely send a connection request these days. And, you know, people send connection requests to me and I will accept based on various, you know, various things, various clues that I look for. And it's a slow connection strategy. Followers is a completely different category, right? I get a lot of followers, thankfully, right? People think enough of me and my content to want to follow me. I love that. But I did switch my connect button to follow, which again slows down the connection roll, right? Someone's not that keen if they can't see the connect button. Oh, he's got a follow button. Maybe I'll take that as a signal that Andy is more interested in having followers at this stage in his career than connections. And then if someone follows me, then that's an opportunity for both of us to sniff each other's tails.
And,
you know, do I want to connect with you after following me? Well, I followed you too. So that's quite a strong signal. So it just takes some of the friction out and it just makes it, I think, a lot smoother in terms of what you're trying to do. But culling, no, in terms of probability and predicting who's going to be useful, the reason I have the almost 10,000 connections is that I can then go into them when I need to help someone else. So there was a friend of ours that moved to Auckland in New Zealand, and she's a corporate lawyer, and she didn't have a job. So I reached out to five of my connections in Auckland, and they all responded and said, sure, I'll get Sarah to get in touch with me. And then that sparked more feel-good stuff happening. So of the five, they said, oh, actually, you know, they each suggested someone else. You know, not my line of work, Andy. However, she needs to get in touch with Tim. Or, you know, oh, Stephen's, you know, big in Auckland. Get in touch with Stephen. So that's the beauty of, I think, having a big network. In your time of need, in someone else's time of need, you then can, you know, really go to as far as that net extends.
Yeah, I like that because, like you said, you just never know. Like, you never know who could be of benefit down the road, or more importantly, who you can benefit down the road.
Exactly.
In some way you may never know about.
Yeah, and that person you cut, right, that you just culled them last week, they could have been the person that opened the door to you or someone else when you asked. That's, right. You know, that's the issue for me.
Yeah, and I guess also too, if you're, you know, if you get started and you connect with people at your company, people don't stay at your company forever. Either they move on to a new company by choice or not, but at some point they may not be there. So keep them in your network as long as you can.
Yeah.
So one question I have, when somebody reaches out to you to connect, there is an accept button and there is an ignore button. If I click the ignore button, does that person get notified that I ignored them?
They do not. They'll never know if you clicked ignore. Essentially, they'll just wonder why it's taking you so long to accept, right? And then eventually they may realize, okay, well, you know, Ryan's either very busy or he's very not interested, and they're going to make that assumption. Okay. So LinkedIn have done that on purpose because, you know, no one wants to know of rejections. Like, ooh, sure. That hurt me. So for sure, I like the fact that no one, the person who reaches out does not get notified that you click ignore.
So for those listening, it's okay to click the ignore button.
It is.
Especially if there's not a good connection, or if there's not you don't feel there's a relevant connection, or more, what I've seen more and more, you 100% know as soon as you click accept, the next thing that's going to happen is your messages are going to be filled with spam and sales stuff.
It's always annoying when that happens. You know, ideally you can kind of predict that if you look at their title and the outreach, you know, what their original message to you said. You know, if it's all about me and less about, hey, you know, I read this, or I thought I agreed with you, what you said the other day, you can sometimes tell. For me, it's people who have, you know, helping coaches with pipelines, stuff like that. I know immediately that they're going to try and sell to me at the first message, so I click ignore. And if I'm feeling particularly cantankerous, I might even click IDK And so, if you're going to push that boilerplate invite message out to a bunch of people like me, you better hope they all don't click IDK, because then you'll be in LinkedIn jail and you'll be restricted in terms of annoying other, you know, busy people with your irrelevant sales garbage.
Right, right. And for those who don't know, IDK means I don't know. And if you click ignore, LinkedIn gives you that opportunity to say, you know, do you know this person?
Exactly. And in a way, it should, in theory, help improve their game, right? Because if their game is so weak that they're getting in LinkedIn jail after a week of pushing out these crappy outreach messages, then they got to go back to basics, go back to the drawing board, and come up with something that actually works.
So speaking of spam, you get a connection request, you look at it, you're going to evaluate whether or not you want to connect with them. I assume you're going to take a look at somebody's profile beforehand. What in general makes a good LinkedIn profile for you?
Yes. So I do prefer a customized connection message, number one, right? If that saves me from going to their profile, if it's that well written, then I can tell, okay, this person is clearly... because I can see their name, I can see their headline, and I can see the message. And if all of those things work for me, then I'm more likely to accept. If those folks who insist on not sending me a message at all, then I'll look at their profile. And then essentially, I think what I'm doing is I'm looking for a potential client of mine, right? A prospect or someone who's in my field. Yeah. And I think those are the two main ones that I look for. There might be a third category. Let's call it interesting. Yeah. There's something that they're doing in their career that is interesting. You know, there's a guy, for example, that I'm messaging with. He responded to one of my posts, and it was about, it was mass tagging today. And he responded, and we have this shared interest of electric vehicles. So we're now getting into this, you know, back and forth, and we're talking about this, and it's highly likely that he and I are going to connect through that interaction. But to answer your question, I am profiling on the profile. I'm looking for those three categories that I mentioned. But the first is, you know, it's always about who I can help, and you know, the second one might be who can help me if they're interested or in the same function. I'm always interested in finding out, you know, who else is in the LinkedIn stroke coaching training field. But I can also, the flip side of that, Ryan, is I can also very quickly determine who is very unlikely to become a prospect of mine. And I can tell straight away. I think most coaches will tell you the same thing. Just know who their client profile looks like from years
doing it. I think if you get enough connection requests, it's pretty easy to spot the spammy ones right away.
Yes. I mean, I did, I think last year, and I used a graphic of a cat looking very sort of cute and cuddly and you know, it was like out of Puss in Boots. I think it was that kind of graphic. But I did use it to highlight all of the shitty connection requests that I'd received in that year, because I kept screenshots. And I blurred everything out, so I didn't embarrass people specifically, you know, which obviously is a no-no. But they all had the same characteristics, Ryan. You know, they were all very vague. Yeah, some of their research was just plain wrong. I wasn't who they said I was, or I wasn't interested in what they said I would be interested in. And you know, I just added my snark alongside their connection request message, their shit connection request messages, and everyone basically said, yes, I'm so tired of getting these. Good. Thanks, Andy, for highlighting this, because you know, it's a common issue. People just don't do it well, and it's a waste of everyone's time. It's a waste of their time in putting it together. You know, even if it's boilerplate, sending it out, it's a waste of their time doing that. And it's a waste of our precious time responding to these nitwits.
Exactly. So I have so many questions, as I said at the beginning. And by the way, for those listening, the majority of the questions that I've asked Andy so far have come from a post on his blog, linkedinsights.com, called The Sophisticated User's Guide to LinkedIn. So I highly recommend you go look it up. When I post this to LinkedIn, I will put a link to that there, but looking at the time, and I really want to get into some conversations about the LinkedIn algorithm. because which is also a blog post on LinkedIn Sites, which is called The LinkedIn Algorithm Explained in 25 Frequently Asked Questions. So go check that out too. But between yourself and Richard Vander Blom, I believe is how he says it.
Yes, correct.
You guys are just a wealth of information when it comes to understanding LinkedIn's algorithm. And I actually let people know I was going to interview you in my Facebook group. And I put out a call for questions. And one of the ones that came back to me, which kind of surprised me, but also maybe didn't surprise me, was why should people care about the algorithm? Like, what is it and why does it matter when it comes to posting things on LinkedIn?
Yeah, it's a great question. So first, I just want to give a shout out to Richard Vander Blom. He's really the person that's opened up research into the algorithm. Last year, he dropped this amazing study, which he did in conjunction with his local marketing university department. He said, I've got a cool project for you. Analyze these 3,000 posts and tell me what you find. And I think what was so key about that was that it confirmed what a lot of authors, LinkedIn authors, already sort of presumed or guessed at was happening on a lot of different fronts. And so my role there was just to bring together, amalgamate all of the knowledge, including Richard's fantastic study, and put it into one article. And that's what I did there. It was more of an amalgamation, more acting as an editor. I think I know my stuff too, but Richard really, you know, set the bar very high. Huge admiration for his work, for sure. So, yeah, why does understanding how the algorithm treats our content on LinkedIn, why should we bother? Why should we be interested? Well, you know, why be blind? If this information is at your fingertips and it's going to take you, oh, I think, by the way, that took something like 7 minutes to read, according to the LinkedIn bot that's now, like, 7 minutes. Okay, good to know. So, I mean, it's just, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you just have a look at this article or another article about what, you know, people think and can confirm, by the way, is happening, right? There are stats here, there's hard data. Just go ahead and write, you know, blind. Just as long as you're happy with the engagement and it's good enough for you and you don't want more, you don't want more eyeballs, then just do that. You know, I have no issue doing that. But personally, I'm research based. I want the data, and if I'm going to put my time, my precious time, into putting something out there, you better believe I want maximum reach, and I want to understand how it works on LinkedIn. So, you know, as I said in the article, yeah, it's the difference between, you know, being in a race and either putting yourself in a Porsche or a Volkswagen Beetle, right? Mm-hmm. That's the difference. There are some people who are winning the race because they're in the faster car, and they're in the faster car because they understand how the system works. That's the difference.
Yeah, it's the rules of the game. So if you want to play, you know, you should know and understand the rules. And one of the rules I found most interesting in your post is the importance of the first hour of a post.
Yeah.
Why does that first hour matter so much?
So, I mean, technically it's the first hour and you're off to the races, but it's every hour subsequent to that. If we're honest, and if we talk about what it takes to actually have maximum reach, there's a huge amount of commitment involved. So the first hour is essentially what a lot of people believe is happening as soon as you click publish. If that is read in silence, right? If your post is read in silence, no one reacts, no one comments, no one reshares, then the algorithm will go, we think this is shit, right? We think this, actually, yeah, this looks like shit. So we're not going to send it to anyone else because we don't want to send any more to other people. So the algorithm is relatively dumb in that respect. It needs us to, you know, just like we were, you know, talking about training the home feed, it does need signals from users to essentially decide, okay, should we send it to more people? Oh, well, we've got a bunch of reactions. Oh, we also got a bunch of comments and some reshares in the first 10 minutes. Oh yeah, we're going to go and send it to another round and keep testing and keep testing and keep testing. So that's what it does. And so you know, my remark about the first hour, it's also the second hour and the third and the fourth, because if you don't go back in and you're not responsive, if you're not actually having dialogue with the people that have taken the time to comment on your post, you're a pretty crappy author, frankly, right? You're a crappy user too. Because why would you do that? I mean, there was a marketer, a very good and famous marketer last week, and I commented on his post, and I didn't get any notifications that he'd responded. Mm. Now, sometimes notifications are glitchy and they don't always come through. But I went back to check specifically on that post. He hadn't responded to any of the people that had taken. And I thought, what? Wow. I mean, yeah, all right, Ryan, stuff happens, right? Maybe he's in hospital, right? Maybe he's sure. got other things, right? Right. But generally speaking, if that's a pattern, if he does that all the time, then why the heck would anyone want to respond to or comment on his next post, right? If that's happened. So you've got to be responsive. You've got to, what I call, baby the post, right? You've got to hold the hand of the post after you've published it if you want maximum reach. That could mean going in all day and responding to those comments timorously, right? As soon as you get it, put a comment in, and not just a throwaway comment, right? It's a meaningful comment where you are seeking to have an engagement with the person that's communing and coalescing around your content. You have a conversation with them, you build relationships. I mean, the comments around posts are the new groups, to my mind, the new LinkedIn groups, because that's really where the community is happening. It's not happening in LinkedIn groups, it's happening around content creation.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned a few things there: likes, shares, comments, reactions. I interviewed Josh Steinle not long ago, and he said he personally doesn't want you to share his stuff. He would prefer you interact with his stuff on his feed. So I'm wondering, in the algorithm, does a reaction, a like, share, or comment carry? Which one do you think carries more weight?
Yeah, so great question. And Josh knows his stuff. I've interviewed him too. He's a fabulous and talented marketer in his own right. I have a lot of time for Josh and what he's achieved. So equal in terms of weight, I would say, you know, comments are still king. They're the ones that, if you think in terms of raw data that LinkedIn can analyze and parse and all of that good stuff, then the most amount of data you're giving to LinkedIn is in the comment form, right? Reshares are interesting. They're a bit of a strange animal. It might be what I was talking about in terms of driven by the user, right? Is that if reshares are seen as a red-headed stepchild, so they're, my tribe is not coalescing around them. They've been reshared to someone else's tribe. And that tribe doesn't know who Andy Foote is, may not even know why this is being reshared in the first place, then of course it's not going to be as effective in terms of reach for that person who's reshared. Might help me a little bit, but not so much. So it's a strange one, and people have always wondered about, well, why are reshares apparently so ineffective? Why are they worth doing in the first place? But my attitude is, well, it's extra. You didn't expect to have that. It's super nice of that person to reshare it anyway. I mean, how nice? How nice the thing to do is the reshare. It's very nice, right? So I always thank the person for sharing. And sometimes I say, with your network. I make the specific point that it's with your network. So, but comments, to answer your question, are still very, very powerful in terms of getting maximum reach and all the eyeballs that you can on your content.
Last question on this, and we're going to move on to a new topic, but hashtags in the algorithm, LinkedIn, I can't remember if it was the product manager or data scientist or somebody came in and said, you need to use three, which I know you've written about as well. But my question for hashtags is actually more to this point, which is how excited should I get if I get notified by LinkedIn that my hashtag post was trending?
Yeah, at this stage, Ryan, not very excited at all for a couple of big reasons. Number one, if you click on that notification, it'll take you to the hashtag stream or feed, and you'll see that, yes, indeed, you're at the top of that feed, and you get excited, and you think, wow, I won today. I won the hashtag race. But if you click on refresh, so you refresh the URL, then that will no longer be the case. Your post will then fall away. It will have dematerialized, which is very odd and very disconcerting. So it kind of makes me believe that it's a mirage, that it's not actually trending at all. And number two, before you click refresh and your post is at the top of that feed, if you look underneath, right, the rest of the feed, which is filtered at top, right, mm-hmm. in terms of all the top content, in theory, right, none of that content below you is trending, right? None mm-hmm. of it is in the high engagement that you are in, that you're in. It's nowhere near. And so it seems to me that this is, it's not exactly bait and switch. It is a bait because you think, oh, this is exciting and I may have achieved something. But in actual fact, you know, LinkedIn have not done the necessary. Why, when you click refresh, does your post disappear? Why is the rest of the stuff not actually trending? Can't they figure this out? So it's broken. It's broken, and they should not be sending those notifications out while those two issues are still present. They need to fix this because a lot of people have said the same thing. I'm not the only person saying this. They all think, well, yeah, but what's the point? You know, and then how is this benefiting me? Right? Am I getting extra eyeballs on this because it's trending? Show me that. Right. Yeah, break that out for me. Give me that data. Right? I mean, it's not like they don't have the data. The thing that excites me about hashtags, not just trending, but maybe they fix trending. But hashtags are, I think, version one right now. I think version two might be very, very cool. For example, if you're able to get really interesting data behind how many times your hashtag was clicked, what time of day your hashtag was clicked, you know, if you have a custom hashtag, if you start getting some of that, that would be pretty neat, if you ask me.
You're making me think about branded hashtags and the number of questions I could ask around that now, but what I want to do instead is talk about Linked Insights. So tell me a little bit about what you do with Linked Insights, how you help people fix the problems that they are struggling with LinkedIn.
Yes. So my model with LinkedInsights.com is that I share 95% of my knowledge, and I do that willingly. I think that's a tried and trusted method of essentially demonstrating your know-how, your capability, your skill, your experience, and talent. So LinkedIn Sites is a perfect vehicle for me because not only do I share my knowledge, but I also share my marketing ability, my branding ability, and my writing ability. So it's all there, right? When people sometimes come to me and say, "Hey, Andy, I'd like to know who you worked with," well, I can't readily do that because I'm a ghostwriter. So it's the ghostwriter's curse. Yeah, I've written all of these great about sections and summaries, but these people would prefer that I keep it discreet on the down low. But I point them to my website, and you know they understand that my capabilities. So it's a great vehicle, and it's 95% of what I know. The other 5% is kept basically for my clients, and it's all about customization. So every about section that I write is unique. And so another reason that I don't show clients that are willing to say, "Hey, I work with Andy," is that it's not going to help you because your about section is going to look completely different. It's not like I do a, "Here's what I do," or, you know, how I do it and why you need to. I don't like that, you know, rigid sort of boilerplate approach to the about section. Don't like that at all. I want a story because everyone has a story. I want the reader to be engaged. And I want them to be sufficiently invigorated and impressed that they take action next and want to, you know, do something with you, whether that's hire you, you know, buy your services, products, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I know Christian Cherry, who I had on the podcast too, talking about UMAP. She has spoken very highly of your services. So she's somebody who definitely was okay with sharing that information.
Yes. Sherry, nice. Sherry's an awesome individual. All of the folks on the UMAP side, by the way, are very impressive individuals.
Okay, last thing I want to talk about, and then we're going to wrap up, is the new podcast that just came out last week. It's called Footnotes, which, by the way, I love the name. The name is like, I don't think you could have picked a better name. It's amazing. So tell me what inspired you to do the podcast and what's it about? When can people expect to see it? Like, how often do you release it?
Yeah. So I had the idea of doing a podcast last year, and I just figured, well, this would be fun. This would be experimental. It would be a great creative outlet. And I always figured, you know, if I do it ever, it's going to be an interview show, because I think that's where, you know, that's where the true content creation and ideas and sharing of good stuff happens. So I always wanted to do an interview show. Hats off to folks who just talk into the mic by themselves nonstop in pod. I mean, I don't think I could do that, not consistently. I might be able to do one episode now and again, but that's like a conversation with myself. It's almost psychoanalysis, I think, sometimes. echo chamber. So, yeah, I wanted to do an interview show. And, you know, it only took me the last 2 months of actually just getting it done to bring it to fruition. And fortunately, the timing was great because, you know, the hardware came available last year, the Rodecaster Pro. I researched the heck out of mics and I found this amazing mic that I absolutely love, my Electro Voice RE20. And the software is very cool, you know, the Squadcast, the Green Room to Meet. And so I figured everything out and it was like a puzzle that came together for me. And now I'm getting more into the groove of being, you know, an interviewer rather than someone who's reading questions. You know the difference, right? The interviewer is much more like relaxed, confident, and happy to go with the flow. The person who reads the questions, I think more rigid, and that can be, you know, that can stymie things. So yeah, the timing has come, the timing has worked out. Plans for the future, I'm going to stick with the interviewing format. I'm going to do more I'm going to do all the transcription. Still got to do that, right? Because that, to your point about people coming to you afterwards, years afterwards, and you having to remind yourself, I think it's because of the, you know, the actual SEO love to written content, not necessarily, you know, just the audio. So I'm going to do that. And then, yeah, dude, the other thing is, I think I've got something like 200 plus people on my list of people to invite.
Yeah.
And awesome. This keeps growing. It just keeps growing. And it's like, I can envisage these conversations already. And I'm looking forward to them. So, and in terms of how much, I think maybe because I've got like a stack that I want to get out there every Tuesday and Thursday, and then I'll slow it down to every Tuesday. There's a lady called Cher Jones, S-E-H-E-R Jones.
Yep. I follow her.
She's one of the very few people doing LinkedIn Live awesomely, just so polished. And of course, no surprise, the reason she's polished is she's got a broadcasting background and career. She's done this for years. You don't get that good without doing this for years. And I usually like her stuff. And when we were chatting the other day, she said, you know what, you should do what Billboard does, drop it every Tuesday evening. I said, okay.
Nice. Yeah, awesome. Well, I can tell you, I've listened to several episodes, and it's good. It's very conversational. I like it. It's, you know, I think you bring the best out of your guests, and just something else I highly recommend people check out when it comes to, you know, following you and learning more about what you do. I've bumped up and taken some of your time, more of your time than I said I would today. So, Andy, for those who want to learn more about you, what you're doing at LinkedIn Sites, subscribe to your podcast, what is the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Yeah, so preferably via LinkedIn, because I'm on LinkedIn a lot, as you might think. But also, you know, LinkedInsights.com. Always happy to have people reach out there and comment on my content. And, you know, I'm pretty good at responding very quickly. So those two, number one and number two, I think would be best. And you know what? We didn't get to dwell time, so we're going to have to do another. By that time, it'll be something else.
Yeah, that's 100% true. So any final thoughts, tips, words of wisdom to anybody who's listening today when it comes to LinkedIn or algorithms or even podcasting, whatever you got?
Yeah, I think two tips. In terms of your about section, everyone has a story, right? So that story, if it gets people to take action, then you've kind of, you know, you kind of sealed the deal. You've done all that's necessary. So, you know, think about that. And number two is, if you're in the content creation space, you're thinking about it, go ahead and look at all of the stuff that's out there. It's not like there's a paucity of information. There's a ton of content out there. Decide, you know, what the good stuff is and why it's good, why you like it, and then reverse engineer. Right? Write the same kind of thing, you know, in your words, but for you, so it fits you, and learn from other people's success in terms of content creation and strategy on LinkedIn.
And I think one of the best ways they can learn from other success is to follow you today. So if you're listening, get out there, do that. Andy, thank you very much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it. And I would love to, at some point in the future, if you're game and have time, since you have 200 podcasts lined up, to do this again so I can ask some more questions.
I love the experience, Ryan. You're a natural, and you made me feel very much at home. Appreciate it, brother.
I'm a natural with 250 plus podcasts under my belt. Right? That's why.
I know. Yeah, what's the expression? I'm an overnight success that took 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Great job.
Today's show was edited and produced by Ryan Roby. The music for today's show is Hudson Hawk by Neon Beach. All music licenses were purchased via soundstripe.com.